Welcome back to the Jazz Podcast. If you have ever been on Twitter and you're a part of the Jazz Twitter community, then you no doubt have followed or seen or retweeted or heard of
or blocked.
Or blocked 5KL. From my perspective, by the way, his name is Chris, and I'll let him introduce himself a little bit, but from my perspective is and was kind of the original Jazz Twitter fan, so to speak. And I want to ask him, you know, who else was there at the start? But, you know, working for the Jazz for years, even when I was brand new in Twitter myself, 5KL was there. Chris, welcome. And how'd I do for your introduction there?
Oh, you were way too kind, but it's cool to be on here, and I appreciate those words. It's first of all, it takes me back. Sometimes you just assume that people know that you did certain things, but then you look back, and it's been so long that there's a whole, you know, there's almost a whole generation of fans that, you know, are new to Twitter and whatnot. Going way back, I started a website, a blog on Blogspot called Basketball John. It was named after, do you remember the Basketball John song?
I do.
The 90s?
Very well.
So I started it because I noticed that, you know, our blogs, this is 2007. So a lot of, that's kind of when blogs started picking up steam. And, I noticed that there wasn't a lot of jazz content. There were a couple, but it was, you know, from a fan standpoint, there wasn't a whole lot. So I just started on Blogspot, and then that's what, 12 years ago. But, you know, technology wise that's like ancient, and, you know, so think of what blogger.com was. I don't even think it was Google. I don't even think it was on Google yet. I don't even think Google had bought them yet. I finally registered basketballjohn.com and made a WordPress site and just started posting there. And then a little while later I found SB Nation. At the time it was called Sports Blog Nation, and then they shortened it, but they had a whole bunch of sites for NFL, and, you know, they still have those today, but they didn't have a jazz one at the time. So I approached them and said, hey, do you guys need a jazz writer? And it kind of took off from there. So that was, I don't know, it was like 2008. Took forever to find a name to name the blog, because they wouldn't let us use anything with Utah or jazz or musical, anything that could be, you know, they were afraid of being receiving a cease and desist from the Jazz or something like that. So anyway, so SLC Dunk was born. It was named after SLC Punk, if you guys know that movie.
Mm-hmm. Matthew Lillard.
Yep. And then joined Twitter. I mean, I think I had to join Twitter as part of being part of SB Nation when it started getting up to speed. And so I had an SLC Dunk account, but then I just had my 5KL account that I made because I wanted a really short handle to use, but I didn't use it very much. Anyway, I ran SLC Dunk until like January 2012. I had kids, and so I was taking a lot more of my time, and so I decided it was time to give up, you know, day-to-day control of that. So that's kind of where it was born.
It's funny because Twitter specifically, as you know, as we know, probably people who are listening for the most part, you know, it's such a different animal than any other social network. Early 09 is when I even first heard of Twitter. So at the time I was an intern at 1320 KFan, when that was still the radio station of the Jazz. And I was only for a semester, you know, it was like a school thing. And I happened to intern on Locke's show, David Locke, when he was on there. And he was talking about Twitter one day, and I was just like, what is this? My first at handle was Locked Intern because of the role I had on the show. You chose yours, 5KL. So brilliant. I wish I would have thought, you know, back in 09, maybe, you know, maybe I didn't have to have the underscore in front of Matt Sanchez or whatever and try to secure something a little, you know, a little shorter or whatever. Side note is a couple weeks ago, I found the guy on Twitter who has the handle at Matt, M-A-T-T. And I thought, oh, I'm going to ask this guy if he'll let me have it. So I sent him a DM, and I'm like, hey, how much for at Matt? You know, thinking maybe he'd say like $500 or some number that's not like crazy. And he's like, well, I've turned down $25,000 before, so it'd have to be more than that. And I was just like, dude, okay, well, you know, I just said props on securing it, you know, have a good day. And I just moved on. But yeah, back in the day, I wonder if I could have got something a little more unique, like 5KL, because you can't get stuff like that anymore.
Oh, yeah, and I think they're all gone anyway. But yeah, like if you try to sign up now for Twitter, it has to be at least 4 characters. So.
Oh, dang. I didn't even realize that.
Really, I mean, yeah, I think all the possibilities are gone anyway. But yeah, they limit that. And this is going to sound, you know, old man-y, but like, I mean, Twitter originally didn't have images, didn't have, you know, it was just text updates for the longest time. And, you know, I remember at my day, we didn't have fancy pictures, right? Like it was just all text and it was, you know, 140. And I mean, most people probably, you know, remember that, but, you know, it's evolved quite a bit. And, you know, every time there's a new change in Twitter, there's a lot of complaints. And, but, you know, you're right. It's just a different, it's a different beast of a social network than anything else. I mean, you can't explain it to, I mean, I remember when we were instructed, okay, everybody sign up for a Twitter account. And I think the first post I put for like SLC Dunk was, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do. We were primarily using it just to post like links to articles we published. And so, you know, you started doing more with, you know, you'd interact and whatnot. But
what happened when Jazz Twitter started becoming more of a community? And it wasn't just people saying, I had a ham sandwich for lunch. Like people were actually like tweeting, you know, either just funny takes or ideas on the team or whatever. Like, do you remember like an era of the team? Was it, you know, like early Hayward days with the Big Al days? Like, can you like put a pin on when maybe it started becoming more of a community and less of just like random updates on Twitter?
I went back and looked at when Woj, sorry, I say Woj in my head, but I know it's Woj, the tweet that he had to break the Darren Williams trade. I looked back at it and it was like 40 retweets and maybe like 100 likes. And that was like last year. I'm like, that's insane to me. And that was 2012, right? Or 2011?
2011, yeah.
So, I mean, that just tells you like there was nobody, it wasn't just Jazz fans. There wasn't that much of a NBA community on at the time. You know, it was primarily, you know, I think it was bloggers and like team employees that were on there, you know, and media, that kind of thing. I don't think it really had the casual fan component on there probably until, I don't know if it was like when companies and stuff started putting, you know, their Facebook and Twitter handles on everything. I don't think I can pinpoint any one time. I think it's just kind of been gradual. And the biggest thing that Twitter became good for was breaking news. I mean, it was, I can't even imagine now, like if Darren Williams had been traded during the era of, you know, not having Twitter, I wouldn't have known until at the earliest later that night when I watched SportsCenter or something like that. Probably that night on KSL or whatever, you know, local radio station. With Twitter, it was, this is what's happening right now. So I think that became a huge appeal. One of the big things that got SLC Dunk and Basketball John popular is that we had game threads. So people wanted to be with like-minded fans and talk about the game and cheer and complain. And, you know, I think Twitter is almost the perfect platform for that. So
yeah.
Twitter is just, it's so convenient. It's really remarkable what it's become.
When I first started working in the Jazz kind of marketing social media department, my lineage, so to speak, in like the Jazz social media world, before me, there was Bill Lee, who I'm sure you know,
yep.
Bill. And before Bill, kind of like the original, I mean, he is the original Jazz social media guy, is Jared Conger. I remember I went over to his cubicle back when all the employees used to work at the arena. And I'm like, I wanted him to tell me about Twitter. And this was probably like 2011, right? And
yeah.
I'm like, what is this like number sign? Like, why do people do that? And he's like, oh, you mean the hashtag? And I'm like, what's the hashtag? I didn't even know.
Oh, yeah, that was
what it was.
No,
you know?
I don't think anybody did. I mean, most people didn't, right? Like it was just a concept that was like completely new across the internet. Now you see it everywhere, but yeah.
Yeah.
You're right.
And now it's, you know, it's funny when teams this is a topic for a totally different day, but, you know, like Take Note, for example, how things can become so synonymous with a team based on their hashtag. And it's kind of, yeah, right. How funny how that has grown. Just listening to you, you know, say like in 07, like you were obviously a huge, huge jazz fan to go and start a blog, first of all, and to kind of grow it into what it's become. Are you from Utah? Have you always been a jazz fan? Have you always just been, you know, super mega interested in the team? Or was there a time or, I mean, I would assume, you know, it's the Stockton and Malone era, but, you know, like take me back to like your earliest like fandom jazz memories.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up like in Southern Idaho. So growing up there, you didn't see jazz games unless they were on like national TV, because I don't think we got K-Jazz or whenever that started for quite a while. So anyway, my earliest memories, though, of the jazz was we just had to listen to them on the radio. So, you know, I remember listening to both a couple of series with the Nuggets and then the series with the Lakers in the late 80s. Like, I wouldn't say enjoy, but I wasn't interested in sports at all really growing up. But around that time is when I started kind of finally liking basketball and football and that kind of thing. So, I mean, just being in proximity to the Jazz, and we didn't really have any exposure to anybody else. I mean, I saw maybe like Celtics and Lakers play, but, you know, that's like way early. I'm a 90s. That's my formative year. So that's really when I started watching them more and, you know, rooting for them. And I was gone, you know, on a mission in a couple of years in the middle. I actually missed the shot. I was in Canada, so I had no idea that even happened. I got home in time for the 98 finals, but I missed the shot. So I've had a few replays on that, but that's just where my fandom started. And I always wonder, like nowadays, like if I grew up in Utah, I'd probably still be a jazz fan. But it makes you wonder, like with the relevance of the internet and all this stuff, like, and having access to more team information other than like the box scores from games that the night before in the paper, you know, if I'd be a fan of another team, you know. But now you can watch any game you want, and you can follow anybody, and you can read anything. And so, yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I like being jazz and a jazz fan, and it's been that way ever since. So,
isn't it funny? And I know we've been talking like technology and stuff. I'm one of these just like stat guys where I wanted to read the box scores, right? And this was like really. I mean, it was, I don't want to say pre-internet, but it was like, I'm talking like 98, 99 or whatever. I needed to read the newspaper every morning so I could see the box scores. However, and I've told some people this, but I guess my family was too cheap to get a newspaper. So like we lived in a circle, like a cul-de-sac, and all of like the mailbox was just like one thing in the middle where all of like the newspaper spots were for like the 6 or 8 houses or whatever. And I would run out there at like 6 a.m. and I would take the sports page out of a random paper and put the paper back in. Like that, how, like, that is like the worst. Like, I feel like there's like some bad like karma coming my way, or maybe has in my life because of that. But I would go out there every morning, take a sports page just so I could sit there with my cereal and look at box scores. And to me, that was like the funnest thing. Like just reading the box scores and being like, oh my gosh, Keith Van Horn had 17 rebounds or whatever. And now kids are like, it's instantaneous, which it isn't necessarily like bad or better or whatever, but it was like this event in your life to go look at the box scores. It's kind of funny.
Oh yeah, I could talk old, you know, uphills both ways in the snow all day on that kind of stuff. When, I mean, you had to wait for box scores and, you know, fantasy football. Or rotary baseball, you know, you had to wait for those scores to come out the next day. I definitely would never go back. I've seen replays of, we watch replays of like the mid-90s basketball games, and they don't even have like the score on the screen most of the time. It's like, where's the score? Who's winning? It's just easy stuff like that you just took for granted, and you're like, show me the score.
I know. It's almost like that's, I guess, why Hot Rod was the way he was, where like every 2 seconds he's saying the score, you know, which was so nice, especially if you're listening on the radio, but you know, every 2 seconds he's saying, it's now 72, 71. We talked a little bit about like your childhood and you know, growing up in the 90s. Was there a player, you know, I'll say besides John and Carl, like, is there a player that when you were a kid or when you first like got on, you know, loving the Jazz that you remember like being your favorite player?
The first was probably Blue Edwards. Like his dunks were, you know, I think Hot Rod used to describe him as like, you know, he'd parachute to the ground when he'd like, you know, dunk and then he'd come, you know, he'd let go and float to the ground. And he's the one, I don't know, I think I have more of his basketball cards outside of John Carl than anybody else, just because, and he has a cool name. I mean, when he makes a shot or a dunk, it was, you know, everybody in the arena would yell Blue. And the other one is probably David Benoit. The Jazz have always been a Sloan, blue-collar, hardworking, you know, team that had been their identity for so long. And then you had, like, these two players that were just, from my, you know, when I was growing up, you know, they were the flashiest of the bunch. And so it was kind of a nice change of pace to watch them. But
no, those are good calls. I mean, Blue and Benoit, and I think, like you said, like, they were, like, the guys, they were, like, the excitement guys. I mean, it's unfair to say Carl and John weren't excitement guys, but like they were like their baskets generally came on dunks, right? Like, and they were like the highlight guys. So yeah, I remember being a kid too, and just like Benoit was so cool because he was just like a high flyer.
Blue Edwards had so many alley oops, you know, that he finished on as well. Benoit just had the, you know, the flash on a lot of those dunks. He was probably like the 90s version of Jeremy Evans, you know, as far as when it comes to dunks and putbacks and just getting up there.
That was when you were a kid. Do you like progressing kind of just through like the Jazz eras, like what other players stand out as like guys that you just gravitated towards loving?
It was Karolinko. I mean, he came along and he was, the stuff that he could do with his passes and his, you know, his dunks, and you can't just rank players. I always just like to put him in like buckets. Obviously you have John and Carl, but like in the top 10 bucket you have like Karolinko, and he's probably right up there with like Memo and Darren Williams. Karolinko, I always want to go back and wonder, you know, what if the Jazz hadn't signed Boozer and he stayed at power forward where he had his best seasons, you know? I mean, he was still fantastic after that, but you know, if you look at his stats and his splits, when he was a power forward, he was incredible. I mean, that was his all-star years when he was a power forward primarily. So, you know, that's a lot of what us, you know, if we hadn't had Boozer you know, cause he went from being, you know, in that season when they were supposed to, you know, tie for probably the worst record in league history to being a game out of the playoffs. He went from the first option to being, was even like fourth option. Cause I mean, they got, once they drafted Darren in 2005, you know, it was Darren, it was Boozer and Memo, you know, at least on the offensive end. He's always been one of, if not my favorite players.
Man, I am so with you on Karolinko. And it's almost unfortunate because it seems like so many fans are split on their feelings. You have a lot of fans like us who are just like so pro AK, and then some who are just all they choose to, you know, because obviously Andre struggled with injuries for like his, you know, last few years with the Jazz, and it was just kind of the way he played, you know, he was always just kind of getting hurt. And I think some fans choose to remember that, and because he had a big contract that they don't think he lived up to. And I think that kind of clouds their vision of how awesome he actually was.
Yeah, that max deal was like, I remember, I mean, this is obviously pre-Twitter and really not too many people online at the time, but I mean, there were some comment boards and there was a lot compared, you know, relatively speaking at the time, but he was your best player and he wasn't just your best player. He was one of the best players in the league. He commanded a max contract. He offered Larry, when he used to have that weekly show with, I think it was with Locke, but he came on one time and there was a trade possibility for, you know, sending AK to the Suns for Sean Marion. And they turned that down, or the Jazz turned it down. And then he also stated that Karolinko offered several times to just cancel my contract. I'll, you know, if it's too much and you don't have to pay me, essentially, you know, if you don't feel it's worth that. Karolinko was more than willing to take on a lesser role when the additional players came on, to take less money or no money, and, you know, did a whole bunch of stuff. So You know, we kind of see that now with Exum, right? Like he got $11 million per, and you know, and everything that everybody, you know, that his detractors want to talk about are his injuries, but they're not like a recurring injury. They're individual, like an ACL, and then he had a player land on him and separate his shoulder. Those aren't like a, you know, you don't have bad knees or, you know, a bad hammy or degenerative condition. It's just those, they were all just fluke. Boozer got a lot of the same flack as well for, you know, some of his injuries. And I'll admit I wasn't the biggest Boozer fan. I mean, from a basketball standpoint, just the defense, it was hard to come up with. But when you see those highlights of that team, that, you know, that team from like 2007 to 2010 or 11, that was a fun team to watch. They probably don't get as much credit as, you know, for what they did. I mean, they accomplished a lot. They were a fun team to watch. So, I mean, they ran into the Lakers buzzsaw and the Spurs buzzsaw too many times.
The podcast the Jazz did with, you know, Darren and kind of Coach Sloan and, you know, talking about them like burying the hatchet, I think that was so great because as a fan, especially of that team, like I really would love to see a time when that team is celebrated in some way. You know, like obviously they didn't win a title or anything, but that was you're so right. Like that was such a fun team and arguably, yeah, like two of the top 10, obviously like Darren's maybe even top five guy the Jazz have ever had. And I would love to see a time when the Jazz like fully embrace them, let them be part of the history again. Like, I think that would be awesome for a fan to be a part of too.
You know, him and Chris Paul were 1-2, whatever, you know, whatever in order you wanted to put them in at the time. He was right there as one of the best point guards in the league. So,
yeah,
it was unfortunate. But, I mean, that's – the Jazz were fortunate to have him. I mean, they could have had Chris Paul as well, you know, and they, you know, either way. So having somebody at that level after they lost, you know, after John retired, but it could have lingered in, you know, mediocrity for a long time.
We're talking a lot about, you know, players and history and AK and certain things. When I kind of invited you on here, I had a specific topic, and we're already kind of talking about all this stuff. I'm always kind of fascinated, and I know it's so subjective, when a player's jersey gets retired. In my opinion, it's because we've retired a lot that they're kind of like, oh, we can't do, like, we've already done too many. But I'm just interested in knowing people's opinions. I put out a Twitter poll last week just to kind of see what people thought. And these aren't like limited. These aren't the only things, reasons to think about. But I said, you know, what's the biggest factor for a team to retire a player's number? And I said, is it their franchise stats, kind of how they rank there? Was it longevity with the team? Is it fan support, you know, like a player that's just beloved? Or was it winning? You know, they were part of a winning team. And the vote was pretty close, but the one that won was longevity with the team, which I think you probably take a combination of all those when you factor it in. I'm such a pro Andre Kirilenko jersey needs to be retired for a lot of reasons.
If for nothing else, that nobody else is ever going to wear 47 never again.
And I think that that's part of it too.
That nickname doesn't, AK-47 is probably one of the, obviously Malone, you know, Mailman's more memorable, but AK-47 might be the most perfect nickname for somebody. I mean, AK, obviously, AK-47 is a Russian invention, there's a number he wore, the perfect nickname.
So I want to get all your thoughts on AK, or, you know, is there other players too? Because recently, obviously, Derek Favors left, and, you know, we played the Pelicans in the preseason, and rightfully so, like, everyone loves Favors. Like, Favors is one of those guys that people just love, and, you know, I saw a lot of fans, you know, talking about, like, retiring his jersey and things like that, and it got me thinking a lot about, like, this topic, and Andre Kirilenko, and I know it was the night, you know, it was, like, Kobe's last game in Utah or whatever, that they decided to kind of celebrate AK, if you remember that a few years ago. And it wasn't a jersey retirement. It was just an AK night. And I think it was such a missed opportunity because let's just look at his stats. When you look at like the top 10 of every statistical category in like Jazz history, like basically every category, AK is in the top 10. So whether it's points, rebounds, assists, steals, blocks, games, minutes played, win shares, box plus minus, every one of those, he's either in the top 5 or the top 10. And I think, I think statistically, he's one of the greatest jazz players ever. And I know you look at guys like Hornacek, for example, whose jersey is retired. He was awesome for the Jazz. But I think when he kind of gets lumped into the glory days and the finals years and everybody loved him, it was one of those like, right. Did he get it because he was so beloved? And I kind of feel like he did. Like his stats were great, but they weren't, you know, like on AK's level. So in your opinion, right. You know, what do you think about like this topic and I mean, kind of in general, but also like AK, like, don't you think he deserves it?
Oh, 110%. I would have had it done shortly after he retired, you know, if it were up to me. For me, there's different, I don't know, there needs to be different levels because, you know, you're right. On one end, I mean, you have the statues, right? And speaking of statues, there's a missing third statue that should be there, but for Sloan, we all know that. I wanted to start fundraiser for that for so long and I just never done it. There's different levels for players in for fans, not just for the Jazz fans, but it really is like a pyramid. Like you have, you know, your first level of statues, right? John Carl and Sloan. Those are it. Maybe, you know, I don't know if you want to put Larry H. Miller there or not as a, you know, as the owner, he has a bust in the arena, but the next level is jersey retirement, right? We have, I think getting back to Karolinko, I mean, I think it's a no-brainer, but especially if you use, like you were talking about, if you use Hornacek and Eaton, if those are the bar for jersey retirement, then AK 100% deserves to be in and have his jersey retired, right? But then you get some players that, like, from a fan standpoint, like, I would love to see, you know, Memo's jersey retired just because, you know, what I thought he meant to the team, and especially where he goes back out and, you know, with a bad Achilles and continues playing and it ends up pretty much ending his career, right? Like he was never the same after that. And Favors is another one. Just, I mean, remember, it hurt to see, I think it's a kid that has number 15 this year. And so I was like, man, that just, I said it on Twitter a few moments, like, there should at least be, I mean, maybe we haven't retired 15, but there should be like a moratorium on it.
Right, like too soon. Like
you can't use this for another year or so until we, you know, at least make sure that you're not going to retire it before you give it to somebody else. You know what I mean? So like make a decision, like, and you could kind of say the same for Darren Williams. I mean, that's kind of a unique situation how he left. But at the same time, it's like, it was still weird after all those good seasons. I can't remember who it was. Was it Josh Howard or I can't remember who it was. Like the next year, the next season after Darren was gone, somebody else was wearing number 8. And it was like, you know, just give it like a year or two moratorium. If you decide, okay, we're not going to retire his number at any point, okay, fine, now it's up for grabs again. But past that, after jersey retirement, there's like another level. I don't even know, like throwing stuff out there, but if there was a committee and they decided, well, we're not going to retire. We're going to retire AK, but we're not going to retire Derek Favors' jersey, right? Like he doesn't meet whatever criteria you want to put up there, even though he probably should be. There's got to be some kind of like Utah Jazz Hall of Fame to honor those players. You know what I mean? Like there's just different levels. And then but then you also have moments. Like, shouldn't there be something that honors like Sunday out of games? Just those moments in history. And like Paul Millsap, like where would you put Paul? Would he get his jersey retired? I mean, that's a hard one, right?
It's such a great discussion. Just me as a fan, I would say he's on the fence, but I would probably say no, but I think he's deserving. Like, if Favors is deserving, I think Paul's deserving.
Yeah, I mean, you can't, if we're up to fans, we probably have no numbers left besides like high 70s and 80s, you know, that you usually can't use anyway. So, but you have players like Millsap and Favors that, you know, do they deserve jersey retirements? You can make that argument, but if they don't, they're definitely like, there's something below there that they need to be recognized, you know, as, and have some kind of recognition as a, you know, that, you know, once a Jazz fan, always a Jazz fan thing.
Yeah.
But it would be nice to have a place where those things can be recognized and those players and moments can be recognized. I mean, another one, like Joe Johnson, game one winner over the Clippers, was one of the best moments in Jazz playoff history. So You know, it would just be nice to have those players in those moments. AK deserves so much more than that. I mean, he kept the Jazz semi-relevant for several years, and not only just relevant, but like, you know, he was a prime factor on those teams in the late 2000s. So
another guy that we haven't mentioned who is kind of up there in a lot of like statistical categories is like Thurl Bailey, for example. I think he's really on the same level as like a Millsap or a Favors. You could totally make a case for him. I hope there was like a discussion there because he was really great. I know he was like the Jazz sixth man for years, right?
So here's a question for you too. What if like Rudy retired today?
Mm-hmm.
Where would he be at in the, if you want to call it a pantheon of
Jazz players, right? It's like, funny because...
like statistically, he's like top 10 already.
The podcast that I recorded with Craig Bowlerjack, we kind of talked about like the top 10 Jazz guys. And like Rudy obviously naturally came up. And like, in my opinion, Rudy is definitely a top 10 Jazz guy already in his career. And so, yeah, like you said, like if he didn't play another game, I think for sure, like he's equal. Like Mark Eaton is such a unique example because of like his gaudy numbers. Rudy's, you know, just as impactful or more impactful or better or more important, you know? So I think for sure, like Rudy is on this Hall of Fame path. And he's right there.
Definitely on the offensive end, right? I mean, you know, different rules and whatnot today, but you know, Mark's offense back in the day was to stand out on the three-point line so his guy wasn't by the basket so that, you know, John and Carl could work on the other side. You know, and he was there for pullbacks and whatnot. But, you know, from an offensive standpoint, Rudy's way, way far ahead of where Mark was. So by the time Rudy's done, he could be number three Jazz man all time behind the statues. So, I mean, he's got better, like, win share, whatever number you want to look at. But John and Carl's longevity will... keep them there probably forever. But, you know, Rudy plays another 10 years at least, and he will be, I mean, if it's all the Jazz, he'll be number three Jazz man all time. And right now, if he retired or for some reason, he would probably be worthy of, you know, comparing, especially when you compare to other people, you know, he'd be worthy of having his jersey retired.
And it's fun to think about, like, Donovan, too, you know, like, how good right. can he get? And if he were to stay on the Jazz, you know, long term or his whole career, he's on this path too. That's to be pretty special also.
Yeah, I think I hope one day that Karolinko gets his due and gets his, you know, an official jersey retirement and recognition rather than just a sidebar on
Kobe night.
On Kobe night, and he gets, you know, a timeout dedicated to him for what he's done for the Jazz organization. So,
well, what do we do? How do we do it?
We got to get him over from Russia. He's on a, I mean, I don't know if you follow him on Instagram or not, but he's like a busy guy running, the Russian Basketball Federation. I don't remember what the whole name is, but he's president of that. And, we've got to get him over here. So I don't know. We could start a campaign. I don't know. I've had so many of those things. I'm like, I really should start a campaign, like with the Sloan statue thing. And then it's like, oh, it's not the right time. It's not, you know, his health is done. And it's like some of these things you just got to do. So I don't know. Maybe we can get it so we can get Moni from Twitter.
Yeah.
Finally come to a Jazz game. maybe that's what would finally get her to come to Utah and come to a Jazz game is if, because she's by far his biggest fan. So, you know, as much as I love him, I think he's been her, you know, she used to have him as her Twitter avatar for the longest time. But anyway, so that's something we should definitely work on.
I know. And you know, she's listening because she told me she listens to these. So especially if we tease this out as a Kirilenko-centric episode. So Moni's the best. And I told her I want her to come on here, but she's a little hesitant right now. So I'm going to try to, like, do my thing and work on her a little
she's
bit.
She's probably listening right now. So we actually, there was one, they do a more regular podcast now on SLC Dunk, But there was actually, we did one podcast, and it was me, Mooney, Clark, if you remember Clark Pollo on Twitter, Leighton Shumway, and there's somebody else, and they're going to kill me because I forgot. Anyway, well, we did like a 45-minute episode. I'm like, that's just way too long. Nobody's ever going to listen to that. So we never did another one after that, and probably because I have a voice for blogging, not for podcasting. So
no, I think this is all like so interesting. I think kind of the whole point of me like doing this podcast is to hear from people like you. And you know, like I said at the start, you know, like I know you based on your at handle, and I always know that there's going to be some really funny, clever tweet, like right away, you know, when something happens, you're like on the ball. So I think it's fun for fans, especially, you know, fans of the Jazz online community, to hear from you guys and to kind of put a voice to your, you know, name. And I think that my whole purpose is just to like make you guys part of, you know, this community in a different way. Obviously, you know, you have been on a podcast before, but yeah, just kind of highlighting you guys again. So, I mean, I'm appreciative that you came on because I'm sure there's a lot better things you could do with an hour of your free time after your kids have gone to bed. And
we all probably spend way too much time on Twitter, but it's a nice creative outlet, just, you know, because I mean, for SLC Dunk, I used to write for that every day. And there was a feature called The Downbeat, which was kind of an evolution of those links that I was talking about way earlier. Downbeat was brought up, named by Leighton Shumway, by the way, at the Shums. You know, I wrote every day, with the exception of like, I think weekends and like holidays. But so it was a nice creative outlet then. And after that, I kind of took a break, and I did stuff for SLC Dunk every once in a while. I'd write a downbeat here and there. But for the most part, Twitter's just, I don't know. I think there is an addiction to it. And, you know, whether it's, you know, getting those likes or, you know, retweets or whatever, or trolling opposing fan bases, it's fun. I probably spend way too much time on there, but
I try
not to be too serious. Yeah. I don't like to be serious on Twitter because I don't think that's the platform for it. But I think for the most part too, people aren't on Twitter for serious discussion. I mean, it's kind of a break from, you know, from reality. And, you know, I think in a lot of cases, you know, the dumber the tweet, the better. And, you know, it's a nice creative outlet to be able to do, whether it's a dumb Photoshop or it's a huge time sink. And so I don't want to be on there just to, if it's not fun, you know what I mean? So I could do a lot of, I could spend my time on other stuff that's way more productive, but, you know, but, that's a lot funner than that. So if you're not having fun on Twitter, I don't, you know, it's not worth being on. So,
well, I mean, I'm happy that I've been able to kind of weasel my way in somewhat to like the community. I think I was lucky to just have the job I did and kind of learn the community of, you know, Jazz social, Jazz Twitter specifically. So it's a fun place to be.
I always enjoy too, just kind of nudging or egging on the official Jazz Twitter account as well. That was always fun. I remember, do you remember, I mean, I Billy, is it just Bill or Billy?
Yeah, Billy.
So when he ran things, I remember one of the things he did, I mean, because the Jazz handle used to be Utah_Jazz.
Right.
Rather than just Utah Jazz. And that was one of the things that he always worked on, that he wanted to work on to get that changed. So it was just Utah Jazz because, yeah, it didn't make sense to have the underscore in there. Anyway, but you remember when Jeremy Evans got selected for his first All-Star or his first slam dunk contest.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't. Were you around during? Were you there during that time?
I was. Yep.
So one of the things that happened, and I'm sure you heard about it, but so I think it was the official Jazz account accidentally posted a video about Jeremy Evans.
Yep, I know exactly.
Going to the slam dunk contest, and so I saw it, and I'm like, oh, that's cool. I'll post it, and then it was deleted. I looked for the file, and it actually was cached on my computer, but I didn't even have to go look for it. It was cached on my computer. So I uploaded it and posted it. That didn't win me any fans.
I think I know exactly what you're talking about. I think like the way that the Jazz back end of the website like worked back then is I think Bill, and I remember this exactly. I remember the day that you're talking about, like Bill like uploaded it, but he never like published it. It's almost like in YouTube, for example, like you can upload a video as like private or whatever, and then like it's not live yet. And I think that's, there was some error or there was something somewhere and it was like visible on the website. I don't even know how long it was. And yeah, and like you saw it and posted it. And I just, yeah, I remember that for sure. Bill is just like the funniest guy where like things like that.
He's brought it up a few times since then, and we've needled him about it a couple times. The other thing I'll tell you this, and you can edit it out if you want, but I made some comments about the 44 United marketing campaign. And I didn't say anything like, I didn't think I said anything like that bad. I just thought it was like kind of confusing because I was like, 44, is that like an airline or is that like, you know what I mean? Like a flight, or it was confusing to me that it was, you know, that's what it was for. And anyway, that I got blocked over that.
I was in the meeting when 44 United was decided on. And It was this funny like brainstorm because like we were, you know, social media, like we're based in the marketing department, and
right.
And we were given this task to like come up with some kind of nickname for like season ticket holders in an office setting, you know, how like, okay, we're bringing in lunch and we're all sitting in this room until we figure it out kind of a thing. I don't know, 12 or 15 people. And we're in this conference room at the arena and they have Maxwell's Pizza. I still have it. I remember because my very first Vine ever was from that meeting. For some reason, I remember that. and we were just like discussing random things and what it meant. And, you know, oh, there's 41 home games. But like the way that like Jazz ticketing is, it's like, well, don't forget about the preseason. There's always three of those. So like obviously everybody knows why 44 United, but like they wouldn't let us do like 41 and...
Oh, that's one of the things where, like, if it was 41 United, well, I would have understood that, right? Like, I would have,
yeah.
Like, just, I was just trying to say, like, from a fan standpoint, like, I didn't understand what 44 was.
Yep, and that's exactly why.
No, it was the same thing. It was like, okay, 41, that makes sense, you know, 41 home games, that makes sense. 44, I was like, I don't get what 44 is, because I don't think, I mean, I guess if you're a season ticket holder, you know what 44 is, because that's including your games, but... Now that's different. You don't necessarily have 44.
Because, yeah, season ticket holders, you have to buy, like, preseason games come with season tickets. Like, you have to buy preseason games. So, like, they made us, you know, like, 44 games is, like, internally, like, it's 44 home games. It's 44 home games, 44. So, like, that number internally probably meant a lot more than externally. So, yeah, I don't think, obviously, that name didn't, you know, work well. And, you know, our boss at the time was just like, once he heard it, I don't even know if he came up with it. It was just like, boom, this is it. We're rolling with it. And this is what it is. Right, we were all just kind of like, okay, you're the boss. Like, we've been in this room for 5 hours. I think we're good. You know, like.
Yeah. And I can see that side of stuff. And I just remember going back and forth and we're like, yeah, we just didn't understand it. You know, it's not a faceless organization, and obviously a lot more now. You know, I know a lot more of the people that are in the social media and some of the marketing and stuff. But that's the other thing. You never know who you're talking to behind the official Jazz Twitter handle, because there's probably like three or four people that can post to that.
Uh-huh.
I'm guessing.
Well, I think...
So I mean, you never know who you're like... You never know who you're like talking to.
Yeah, I think now there's probably... 5 or 6 people who have the like password to it. So yeah, I think it's mainly run by like 3, you know, like mainly 1, but like 3 primarily. But yeah, they think there's several that have the access to it. Yeah, the good old days of running at Utah Jazz. We've been talking for a while, which I really appreciate. I think this is so, to me, and I think a lot of fans, like this is just stuff that's fun to listen to. Kind of my tradition is to talk, what is your favorite television show, and kind of see where conversation goes from there. So what do you got?
If you followed me on Twitter for any amount of time, the only references I usually ever make are like Seinfeld. Growing up in that age, there was no DVRs or anything like that. Like if you missed it, you missed it. And in fact, when I used to watch Seinfeld, when the end credits would come, or when the, not the end credits, but the, you know, when the show was over, like we would switch the channel because you had to switch the channel. Otherwise you might miss beginning of, the next show, right? It was probably like mid-2000s that I realized when I would start watching like reruns, but there was actually like that little post-commercial, post-credit portion of Seinfeld.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah.
Like, so like when I found out, cause I, when we first got, when I got our, my first DVR, it was like 2005, 2006. So we could record the whole thing. And it was like, holy crap. I've got like 200 more little tidbits of Seinfeld that I've never seen before in my entire life because I didn't even know they existed. I thought, you know, once that laugh track hits at the end, after the episode's over, that was it. I had no idea that there was anything else after that. Seinfeld, for me, there's so much good TV on now, too, but so much that I probably should watch, like, but I don't. I just go back to watching Seinfeld.
See, I knew you were going to say Seinfeld because I always see your references, and I usually try to, like, reply with some other reference from maybe like the next line of dialogue or something. Like, I just love seeing right. Seinfeld references.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it. I can't get enough Seinfeld. And I literally watch every now and then I'll sprinkle in an episode of like The Office or something, but I literally watch Seinfeld every night before I go to bed. Every single night I'm watching Hulu, and my wife, it used to be the DVDs before I got Hulu, but and my wife is just like on board. Like at first she was just like, do we have to have a TV in our bedroom? And I'm like, and I, you know, not even answer and just keep watching Seinfeld. And now she like, are you turning on Seinfeld? And like, so I've kind of like converted her to like, we got to watch it. And I honestly, I'm one of these guys. I just never get tired of it. Like I will just watch it and watch it. And I don't know if there's just like something that happened to me or there's some kind of sickness I have, but like I never get tired of it. And I always laugh. Like I know exactly what's coming. I have everything memorized and I can't get enough.
Yeah. You can recite the episode in your head and it's still just like just a delivery. It's incredible to me that like Seinfeld, I mean, it is so liked because when you think about it, they're like four of the most, like in real life, they would be like four of the most unlikable people. Like they have no redeemable qualities about them, right? Self-centered, selfish. I've grown on the finale. I didn't like it at first because I just thought it was like another recap episode, essentially. But that's really what they are. They're just like, I mean, think of any episode. There's like no, like whether it's Jerry and his girlfriend, you know, whether it's George. I mean, George is like my wife. Like she loves Seinfeld as well. She's like, I hate George. I'm like, you're supposed to hate George. George is the worst. Like nobody likes George. You're not supposed, like how he would get like half decent women to go out with him. I have no idea.
I feel so bad for Susan. I still feel bad for Susan.
Well, you know that nobody, like in real life, they didn't like her.
I didn't know that.
That's why they killed her. That's why they killed her off, because like in real life, like nobody liked working with her and they killed her. They killed her off. So it's like a real life Seinfeld. Those four decided they didn't want to work with her anymore.
What comes to mind when you think like best episode or episodes? I know they're all like the best, but like, do you have one that's just like the golden episode?
Jerry was right. Like to go out on top, because that like they're all excellent. Like they're all perfect and tie into each other. But that season 9 was like some of the most high level episodes there ever were. Like it's incredible. Like he could have I think at the time he turned down like $5 million per episode or something ridiculous like that, especially back in 1999, right? He turned that down. And he really did go out on top with that, because that season 9 is expert, you know, excellent. So,
and I think of season 9, the ones that always come to my mind are, it's the episode's called The Strike, which people know it as The Festivus. And then
yep.
This is a random one, but I love the slicer episode in season 9. It is so random.
Oh, yeah.
Kramer has that slicer. And there's something about Mr. Krueger. Like he's like the best boss George ever had. And just like the storylines and like that episode is just so good. And it's the one with like they're trying to get him out of the
pimple
photo.
Popper MD.
Yeah, the pimple popper.
And he's like, you know, he's trying to like break up with her by, you know, saying, how dare you call yourself a doctor, you know, lifesaver. And
take a big zit to kill a man.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, skin cancer. Oh, I mean, you can't go wrong with any of the classes. Like, for me, though, like the marine biologist
mm-hmm.
is just the way that everything tied together, and the way like they, I mean, that last scene, the last dialogue by George was just, it was like written right before he acted it out. I remember when I first watched that, and I had no idea what was coming. And then he pulled that golf ball out of the out of his pocket, and I remember this day. I fell off the couch, dying. Like I didn't even know what happened after that. Obviously, the episode ended, and Kramer delivers. Oh, is that a titleist? I mean, it's just perfect.
The writing. It's brilliant.
That one's 1A. 1B for me would be Mr. Bookman.
The library cop.
The library cop, yeah. That dialogue between him and Jerry is like just some of the most classic there is. And you have Kent's Tangia. You have that whole thing. That whole episode is I could just watch those two over and over again, and I think you would get like something different every time. And so I don't know. It's just one of those things. That's like, it's some of the most quotable. Like my wife and I say stuff from Seinfeld all the time now that we say, we know it's from that, but we say it so often. It's like just part of our vernacular. Like, you know, we'll say, that's a shame. Or, you know, like when Elaine is, you know, when Kramer adopts a highway and he blacks out the lane and it's like super wide and Elaine's driving and it's like, oh, this is so luxurious. So we say that all the time about that. I'm like, oh, look at this. This is so luxurious.
So last part of Seinfeld question, and then we'll kind of wrap it up, is I'm going to give you four side characters, okay? And I narrowed down the four. I might miss someone, but these are, in my opinion, the best four side characters, and I want you to tell me who you think is the top. Mr. Peterman, Frank Costanza.
Are you ranking these, or are there just four?
So I have my favorite. These aren't in any order. So you got Peterman,
okay, gotcha.
Frank Costanza, Putty, and Newman. Who is your favorite of those four?
See, I consider Newman I know he's a role character, but like a side character, he's not one of the main four. I mean, he was one that was supposed to be he was supposed to only be like on one or two episodes, right? And like die, and that was supposed to be it. He doesn't even appear on screen for his first one. It's just voice. But of those four, okay, so let me make a pitch for each. Mr. Peterman, like, he was a perfect boss for Elaine just because he's so eccentric. And, you know, the episode, the Susie,
yeah.
That ending when he gives, like, the funeral where he gives that speech about giving into temptation and he and Susie went at it.
It was pretty good.
I mean, it's just... So I love him. Huddy... him and Elaine were like perfect. Like they fed off each other so well. You know, whether it was like when they were breaking up or getting back together on the plane three or four times.
Vegetable lasagna.
Vegetable lasagna, God, dude. That poor guy. Frank Costanza, he gives like some of the most memorable lines for a role character. The way he treats George is classic. Like you can totally see why George turned out the way he did, right? Like from his parents. And then who was the last one?
Newman.
See, Newman for me is the runaway, but like I said, I consider him a bigger role than a role player. But
he's his own tier. Newman,
he's Jerry's villain, right? Like he, you know, Jerry always compared him, like, you know, Seinfeld, Superman and Lex Luthor.
Yeah.
Like, Newman was Jerry's Lex Luthor, and, you know, he was his mortal enemy. So I thought he was always more than just a role player. Like he was his counter, or his villain, his opposite. That's another episode. The opposite.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Like classic. That's just it doesn't get better than that. Right? That's so good. So I have those three, though, if I throw Newman out, because I think he's the runaway winner. But I love Putty. Like, he's the perfect, like, think of Elaine's character. And, like, she's, like, probably one of the funniest, not just female leads of the 90s, like, sitcoms, but, like, ever, right? But in real life, like, she would never end up with a guy like Putty, right? But... kind of in a way, like with Mike Scott from The Office and, oh, who's the boss's name?
Oh, Jan Levinson.
Oh, Jan, yeah. I was going to say Pam, but I know that was... Anyway, but with Jan, it's like she would never go out with Mike Scott, right?
Right.
Like normally. But there was something that she even said she was attracted to him. I can't turn away. Elaine's character would never date Putty, right? Like, he's just a dumb jock mechanic.
Grease monkey, right?
Whatever, right?
I don't care for that.
Like, she drove after JFK Jr. and, right? Like, but those two fed off each other perfectly. And he was like, you know, whether it was like half the eight ball, you know, in his jacket, or, you know, painting his face up with the devil, really could talk about like individual role players, role characters from Seinfeld, and have like episodes worth
talking
about them.
You mentioned like you and your wife talking about like lines that you just slip into your own natural conversation. Like some of the Putty ones that I always do, like when he's the face painter and he says, because then he paints his chest and he says, "Oh, that's the letter D." And as you can see, this is not my face. And just the way he says it and the way he's looking at her, that's something that I say to my wife, even if it's like totally out of context. And like, we always laugh. It's like the best. And as you can see, this is not my face. And it's just, it's so great. And just like that actor, like, oh man, he's so great.
Yeah. I love Putty. I mean, he's good. And, Patrick's good in other stuff as well, but he's just, to me, he'll always be Putty just for that role.
We need to start a Seinfeld podcast too.
Definitely. I have one trivia question for you.
Oh, okay.
After the main four, who is the fifth most credited actor on Seinfeld? So who's credited for most appearances?
I think I know the answer to this.
Oh, yeah?
So I forget her last name. It's the cashier. Her name's Ruthie, right? The cashier at Monk's.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to say it's like Ruthie Bolton or something like that. I can't remember her last name.
Cohen, yep.
And, Cohen, yeah, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think she goes by the same name in the, I don't think they ever say her full name in the episode. Maybe they do.
Yeah, I can't remember. There's one episode where like Jerry's like, oh yeah, Ruthie Cohen, oh, of course. Like, it's almost like, everyone's, it's almost like she's Gunther and Friends or something. Like, everyone just loves her and knows her. And there's someone, I think it's George. Maybe it's like the episode with the lips on the $20 bill and George is like hating her. And Jerry's like, what do you mean? Like, we love her. Yeah, that's, I think I heard that somewhere. Maybe it was on the DVDs or something. Cause I really am like this nerd where I just watch stuff about Seinfeld. I can't get enough.
I asked that on Twitter a long time ago. It's been a while, but that's like always one of my go-to trivia for Seinfeld, just because it's always, you know, you always think, and I, you know, if I hadn't looked it up a long time ago, I would have thought, you know, it was either, Newman or, you know, one of the Costanza.
Right. Susan parents. Or something. Really, honestly, thank you again for talking. I think I always kind of have to like cut these short because I think we could just keep going. But this is a fun episode. I think it's fans are going to like listening, you know, especially fans of the Jazz social Twitter community. It's just like good conversation about AK and just, you know, those origins of, you know, Twitter and the origins of like blogging and SLC Dunk. So, yeah, I think this has been great.
They can just listen at like 1.5 times speed. And it'll be like a regular 40-minute episode.
Yeah, there you go. But thanks, everyone, for listening to Jazzed. And thanks again to Chris. Follow him on Twitter at 5KL if you're not already. Make sure to retweet him. Don't mute him. Don't block him. And I'll definitely text Conger to unblock you. So, yeah, go Jazz.